Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Rebecca Christie, your host, and I am here with Ben McWilliams and André Sapir, also both of Bruegel. Ben is an affiliate fellow specializing in energy. André is a senior fellow specializing in trade and economics and all kinds of great things. And we are here today to talk about something heavy, the two-year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what it means for Europe to have had a war on its eastern borders for so long. André, can you tell us a little bit about how the world changed when this happened and where we find ourselves now?
Well, the world had already changed to an important extent before this war. And that was, I would say, the US-China conflict, which was dividing the world and was creating certainly a big issue for Europe. You know, we're obviously much closer to the US than to China, but we were trying to find some way, some space in between. And I think we were still very much in that mindset. Then obviously COVID. And I think we had a sentiment that the European front, the large European front, was fairly calm. And war was certainly not something that we were prepared for. I mean, we are programmed, if anything, for peace, not for war. I mean, the European project is about peace in Europe and not about war. So when the war came, I think we were in disbelief. There was certainly the issue of the energy dependency, and we are going to talk about that with Ben, who knows a lot about that. But if I look in sort of the geopolitics, I think there was both an internal and a global issue for Europe. I personally had great fear that the invasion by Russia of Ukraine was going to divide the European Union. We had been divided during the financial crisis in a north-south divide. And now my fear was that we would have an east-west divide. And you will remember that the Polish prime minister came out rightly, said that, you know, I'd been saying that to you, the countries of the rest of the European Union, especially those of Western Europe, that we are much too close to Russia in terms of our dependency for energy, and that we should be much more careful. And so my fear was that not only Poland, but other countries of Central and Eastern Europe were on the front line in this conflict, that have borders with Ukraine, or border with Russia, or border with this Eastern Front. They were going to take positions inside the European Union that were very, very different from the position of the Western European country, that we were going to be much more shy in our response to the demands by Ukraine that we give them candidate status, while the countries of Central and Eastern Europe would have said, you know, yes, we need to go in that direction. So that was fear number one, this division, and I think very unpleasant division, east-west, inside the EU. And then my second fear was, which I thought, I think almost immediately, was China. Where is China going to stand about this? And that was, you know, the issue of what is it going to do with not only our relationship towards China, but the relationship between China and the US and the split. So this new Cold War that was already looming between the US and China, and, you know, what was going to be our position. So I very much wondered in the first few days, what is going to be the position of China vis-a-vis the conflict, and what are the consequences for the geopolitics? We saw, and let me maybe stop with that, we saw, I think, interesting and worrisome, in a sense, development from our viewpoint, from the global south, not just about China, but India, Brazil, South Africa. I mean, in a sense, okay, we saw their votes in the UN, but I think we realized that we are lacking friends, or if you want to put it more gently, that, you know, for them, this is a war in Europe, and there are wars in other parts of the world, and, you know, it's not their war. It's not the war for India, it's not the war for Brazil, it's not the war for South Africa, not even for China. And, you know, we are on our own, but obviously with the Americans. So what the war has done, it has certainly brought us much, much closer to the U.S. Luckily, we had President Biden, then it was much easier to come closer to the U.S. administration. But now, with the U.S. election looming in November and the possibility of Trump coming back, that is certainly making our life very, very difficult. So we have been reprogramming ourselves. We are doing that, I think, very, very fast, but maybe events are going even faster than we are able to reprogram ourselves. But reprogramming is, I think, what Europe is trying to do and is doing.
You talk about the fragmentation that we could have seen as this unfolded. And in fact, Europe has been fairly speedy with its response to Ukraine, putting together sanctions packages, putting out aid, getting Ukraine into the candidate pipeline, and even agreeing to begin accession talks. We have not seen the sorts of large taking sides groups that could have happened. But we have seen a few countries, notably Hungary, resist this unity. Briefly, how big of a challenge is that?
Well, I would say it's very annoying, no doubt, but I don't think it's more than that. And we saw that recently about the 50 billion aid package. It went through with all 27 countries on board, even though there was a plan B to do this outside of the EU and to do, you know, 26 countries. And it would have been a possibility. And I think Hungary understood that in the end yielded. So we were, I think, a bit lucky also that there was a change of government in Poland, a much more pro-European or very pro-European government now in place. So there was not anymore what we had seen during a few months, sort of an alliance or a potential alliance between Poland and Hungary. So by the time the government changed in Poland a few months ago, Orban was alone in that position. And I think that made life much more easy. So I would say, yes, it's very annoying, obviously, for Europe. Unity is always very, very crucial. And the fact that there was one country, Hungary, that was hindering that unity is obviously a problem. But as I said, I think it's more annoying than a deep problem, because in the end, Hungary is a small country and it's a country that does need help from other countries, including money. So I think its bargaining chips are not that great.
It's remarkable that for all of the challenges with Hungary and with some of these alliances, we didn't see any challenge on the funding side of this. 50 billion is a lot of money. It has a substantial public borrowing component at the EU level. And as someone for me who's been following the EU path toward joint borrowing for a long time, the fact that this is such a natural part of the toolkit, and the fact that I think it's 33 billion euros up to in this facility is a non-event now, is something that I think is a real milestone for European integration. Ben, energy has been one of the sectors most upended by this war, particularly for countries like Germany that were very dependent on Russian energy sources. Can you give us the bird's eye view of how this happened and what happened, and then talk to us about where we're going?
Sure. And I first say it's a pleasure to be on the podcast for the first time under your stewardship. Energy. EU and Russia, there are multiple different fuels that we trade with Russia, but the two big ones historically have been natural gas and oil. And that's where we've seen the real crises or the real impacts over the last couple of years. Starting with natural gas, where I think people are the most familiar, the big problem at the onset of the invasion, and even a few months before the invasion, was that Russia supplied about 40% of the EU's natural gas supply. And it became very quickly quite clear that the Kremlin and Russia were willing to use gas as a tool to exert geopolitical pressure, to try and perhaps bully or push some countries into taking certain political stances favoring Russia. This wasn't made explicitly public, but I alluded to the behavior even before the invasion. There was kind of non-market behavior going on with Gazprom, who's responsible for Russian gas flows to Europe before the crisis. So in fact, ourselves, we, I think in December of 21, had a blog post already raising the alarm and saying, what's going on here? Have we got enough gas in storages, et cetera? And that was driven by Gazprom. For natural gas, the EU has been pretty good. It's been able to respond and reduce significantly its dependence on Russia. The 40% number is now about 10%. So today, about 10% of our gas is supplied from Russia. It's still 10% because there's no sanctions. The EU hasn't been the one who pushed and reduced this dependence or imports of Russian natural gas. It rather came from the Russian side. And that was largely achieved by an increase in imports of liquefied gas. A lot came from America. Andre mentioned that we've moved closer to America geopolitically, perhaps also in energy terms, particularly for natural gas, but also for oil. We now import significantly more from the US than we did 2 years ago. And the other big thing was that we reduced substantially demand for gas in Europe, which was largely driven by the substantial increase in prices that we saw over the last couple of years. And maybe quickly to give the overview on oil. There, that's somewhere where the EU felt more confident. And around June of 22, if I get my years correct, the EU imposed or agreed its own sanctions on Russian oil. So it felt a bit more confident there that we could survive without Russian oil, which I think was the correct analysis. And the EU imposed sanctions, which kicked in toward the end of 2022 on both Russian crude oil and Russian oil products, which is things like diesel and gasoline that you put in your car. And there, the EU has been pretty successfully, without too many issues, been able to reduce oil imports from about 25% to close to zero. Again, there are still some marginal flows. There were some exemptions for particular countries who are deemed to be very dependent. So it's not quite at zero. But the EU there has been very able to reduce the dependence, largely because the oil market is a very liquid market. Oil is imported by big ships into ports. And if you don't buy it from Russia, it's much easier to buy that from other countries, which is different from gas, where we had big pipelines and it was a problem to get gas into the right places around Europe.
Natural gas is such a big part of Europe's energy infrastructure, and there have been such strides made with the storage and the shifts. Also, energy prices have been so wild these last 2 years. How would you give the hindsight overview of the surge in energy prices, the reduction in energy prices? Some of that is Ukraine-related, some of it's not.
Sure, there's two distinct categories here. You have natural gas and electricity sit by themselves, and oil sits separately. And oil, there's other factors that have been going on, decisions by OPEC, decisions by Saudi Arabia, decisions by the states on releasing crude oil from their reserves. That all influences oil, the global economy. And that it's a bit of a fool's game to try and predict the oil price, even though many banks do it, and I guess somewhat successfully, but that's very difficult. And the oil price, where we have seen fluctuations over the last couple of years, has been driven a bit by this Russian tension, but by a lot of other factors, particularly for the EU. What we can point directly to Russia and the tension for is, I said, natural gas and electricity. The reason I put electricity there is we produce a large amount of our electricity today from natural gas. And hence, if the price of natural gas goes up, so does the price of electricity. A typical rule is it takes about 2 units of gas to make 1 unit of electricity. So you can kind of calculate your pass-through of prices from this. Natural gas, we saw big spikes throughout 2022 and going into the 22-23 winter for a couple of reasons. The first, at the beginning of the winter, was that European countries were just desperate to put gas into storage, which was smart. And that was the way that you solidified your position going into the winter, was ramming your storages full, which give you about 2 or 3 months worth of supply over the winter. So alongside imports from America, from Norway, from Algeria, if you really filled the storages, you could see a path for surviving the winter, but you had to fill them. And that meant around August of 22, we saw a really big spike in prices. And that was actually driven a large part just by governments giving huge subsidies for filling up storages. It also came not long after June or July. I don't recall the exact date. That's when the Nord Stream 1 pipeline was blown up, which again caused a lot of tensions. And the second factor in prices has just been this: markets continually reassessing the position. And it was very difficult to plan because there was never a point in which Russia said, that's it, you're not getting gas anymore. It was rather, I think it was calculated, a series of moves where first they asked for payments in rubles, which they knew would be difficult. And then they reduced flows, or they were always talking of maintenance. So for example, the Nord Stream pipeline, before it was blown up, they'd already reduced flows very significantly to about 20% what they should be. And they said that was maintenance. So they, I think there was a part in Canada that they couldn't get because of sanctions. So there was always a problem, and it was never an explicit thing that we don't sell you gas anymore. Unlike oil, where it was explicit, it was an embargo gone, we don't get it anymore. And that's part of the reason why we've seen this roller coaster where markets reacted to waking up in the morning and suddenly something happened from the Kremlin and you saw either a big jump or a big drop in prices. Fortunately, now they've come back down almost to where they used to be.
Thank you both for setting the scene so well. When we come back, we'll talk more about the global economy and how the different pieces fit together. Andre, you talked in your opening remarks about China and how for them this is not the number one issue like it is for countries closer to the front. How does this fit in the broader context of the EU's effort to rebalance its relationship with China? On the one hand, there are some real benefits from having China supply commodities that the EU needs. On the other hand, there are concerns about strategic autonomy and oversupply of some of these very same important parts. And on the third hand, there are security concerns on everything from semiconductors to, you know, even supplies of electricity generating components.
Yes, I would say our relationship with China has been damaged quite severely, in fact. For the reason that you indicate, I think we were receiving pressure from the U.S. administration under Trump, but even under Biden before the war, to reduce our relationship with China, as the U.S. started to do under Trump, which we had not done at all, actually quite the contrary. If you look at the share of China in our total imports, it had been rising even after Trump and when Biden became president. So there was sort of a divergence. The U.S. was reducing its dependency and we were continuing to increase it to the displeasure of the United States. But I think the view in Europe, both for economic and political reason, was that, you know, we need to find our own approach to China autonomously from the United States. Now, when the war between Russia and Ukraine started, that immediately changed our view of the world about China as well. Because yes, obviously, our dependency on gas from Russia, as Ben has just explained, was very, very important. And, you know, initially, there was obviously great, great concern in Europe about not only the price, but availability of gas. And the fact that we had become so dependent on Russian gas raised issues about our dependency on a country like China that started to be viewed much more in the light of the Russian aggression to Ukraine and the use, the weaponization of trade. So that was always present in the mind. It was always suggested by the Americans that, you know, we should be careful. But then we saw it for ourselves. What effect it can have in the case of Russia. And no doubt that did change the conversation in Europe in terms of our dependency vis-a-vis China. You remember that the strategic autonomy concept, maybe today it sounds a bit strange to say that, but it was really initially put forward in Europe in relationship to the United States and to Trump. There was a worry already then when Trump became president, and his remarks already then when he was the president about NATO, that maybe we had been too reliant on the United States for our defense. As it turned out, we were too reliant on Russia for the supply of gas. And so the strategic autonomy had clearly a component about China, but there was also a component about the United States, or at least about Trump's United States. With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the behavior of Russia towards Europe, our concept of strategic autonomy started to be deployed, obviously vis-a-vis Russia, number one, but as I said already, vis-a-vis China, much, much more than we would have done in the absence of the conflict. And I think, in a sense, there is no turning back. For a variety of reasons, yes, strategic autonomy has become no synonymous in Europe about China, essentially, even though people now, again, are obviously pronouncing the word Trump, the possibility that Trump will come back, and that may serve as well in case he gets reelected and some of his threats concerning NATO, other threats, are put in practice. But, it is interesting that we have become much more careful in our relationship with China. And as you said, semiconductors, rare earths, all of those products that where there is an important China component, and then obviously all the products that relate to the green transition, they are playing a very important role in the shaping of our policies, of our trade policies, of our industrial policies, of our climate policies, throughout all our policies, I think, because the green transition is so important, because the role of China is so important there, and the possibility that, yes, indeed, as China did already in the case of Lithuania, because of the relationship with Taiwan, that China may be weaponizing trade. So clearly, the war between Ukraine and Russia has meant that we are slowly shifting and not delinking, but reducing our dependency on China.
Ben, China plays such an important role in the energy conversation because it is supplying components for the green transition and for renewable energy. It's seen as a competitor in manufacturing these components, and it's seen as part of the conversation about who's still providing a market for Russian oil, who's buying Russian oil. Can you sort through some of that for us?
Sure. Beginning with the first angle, perhaps, and following on from what Andrei has just been discussing about, it seems in energy and climate policy over the last couple of years, there's really been a change in thinking in Brussels, but also in European national capitals, and I think, in fact, in national capitals around the world. Particularly in Europe, we had a period of 10 years in the past where we focused a lot on carbon pricing, regulations, and how we can push consumers to emit less carbon. And now, over the last couple of years, driven by COVID, driven by the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the exposition there of some of our vulnerabilities, we're now seeing a huge focus on the manufacturing side. Now in climate, the question is coming of competition and EU seeing as a threat this fact that China produces many of the components and even the final products that we need for our green products and our green future in the EU. A couple of examples at the moment. The European Commission has launched an anti-dumping investigation into Chinese electric vehicles. So the Commission, not pushed by industry of its own accord, came forward and launched an investigation against China, beginning to investigate whether or not they're selling their electric vehicles into the EU at below market prices. And another example is solar panels, where over the last couple of weeks, the European solar industry is coming forward and asking for support from the European Commission or from national governments, because they're also saying they can't compete with China on these low-cost products, which on the one hand, as someone working in energy and climate policy, is actually great news. If China is able to produce all of these commodities at a really cheap price, that's amazing. That allows consumers to buy electric vehicles, put solar panels on their roofs at a much cheaper price than we might have otherwise anticipated, and it enables the green transition. On the other hand, there are clearly issues where, particularly something like the automobile sector, where Europe has a long history and a huge employment still today, if all of a sudden we shift away from petrol and diesel vehicles towards electric vehicles, and they're all made in China, then we have a problem.
Can you come back to this question of China as a potential market for Russian oil and how that prolongs this conflict?
And the second point you raise in your question is the role China, and I would extend that also to India, plays at the moment in facilitating the redirection of Russian oil or gas exports. And the simplistic and quick view is that for oil, Russia has been very well able to redirect these exports. I mentioned when talking about the EU that this is traded by sea, coming into ports, that the EU was well able to adapt. And for largely the same reasons, Russia has been well able to adapt. And its oil exports are almost untouched. They're essentially the same as they were before the European embargo was introduced. So for oil, Russia has been very well able to redirect this elsewhere. And perhaps most concerningly for the EU and the G7, if we cast our minds back, there was the price cap introduced. That was the idea. Because the EU and the G7, they're responsible for many of the ships and the insurance services which facilitate Russian oil trade. The idea was to introduce a price cap. And so you're not allowed to facilitate this trade unless you do it below a price, which was set at $60 a barrel. For the first half of 2023, it looked like it was working. The price was below $60. In the second half of 2023, we realized it wasn't. And Russian oil, it trades at a discount. It's about $15 below global prices because it has to go to India, because Europe's embargoed it. But the price is above $60 today, and the price cap is not having any impact, which is really a concern for the EU and G7. And it's something they're very quiet about. I think it's something that's been forgotten about. But if you want to have a meaningful price cap, a basic criteria is that oil has to be sold below that cap, and that's not happening. And just briefly to mention for natural gas, the situation there is very different. Most of the gas, or all of the gas Russia was sending to Europe, came from its Western gas fields. It also has gas fields in the East, which it supplies China with, but these two gas fields aren't connected. And what that means is for the time being, pretty much all of the gas which Russia was sending to the EU previously, it can't send anywhere, and that sits underground, which is a problem for Russia. But I would close by mentioning that oil is far more relevant to the Kremlin's budget than gas. So this problem of not being able to sell gas isn't that relevant when they're still able to sell their oil to China, to India, to Turkey, and get significant revenues from this.
As we close out this podcast, Andre, how long can Russia keep doing this? The Russian economy seems like it's doing okay. Putin has not shown any signs of wanting to stop the conflict. How long are we going to be stuck in this?
I wish I knew that one. I mean, depends obviously the way you look at it, and I think we all agree that whether or not Trump will be reelected as president in November will have a very big impact on the outcome of this war. So I think there are all kinds of scenarios, obviously, and partly depending on the U.S. election. I think in Europe, we are clearly making progress in defense. I mean, we come from very, very far. And as I said before, you know, the European project is a peace project. So we were not ready for war, not even intellectually, including myself. So I think there is that mindset change, and there is also on the ground in industry, there is some change, but obviously we are, you know, maybe 10 years behind. So without the United States playing an important role in supplying weapons, I think that would be very, very difficult for Ukraine to fulfill its war objectives. So are we going to get into a situation where there will be a reversal of fortunes for one side, for the other, because of the politics in the United States, and that will precipitate an outcome pretty fast? Or Are we going to have sort of a frozen conflict with skirmishes going on for many, many, many years? Hard to say. What is clear is that in the meantime, Ukraine is negotiating access to the European Union. And I think that is giving some hope to the Ukrainian population that there is life and there is some kind of hope after the war, whatever after the war means. So lots of question marks, really. Very hard to say, you know, maybe the objective of Russia is simply, quote unquote, to prevent, not to win the war, in a sense that, you know, we understand winning the war of taking territory, but to prevent Ukraine from acceding to the European Union to be a normal country that can sort of move forward. And that could be, I think that could be a very, very dark scenario for Ukraine and a very dark scenario for us, because there's not much we can do there in this kind of situation where, you know, you're neither at war nor at peace. And it goes on and on. And I think that probably, as we see, I mean, as Putin said the other day in his interview on American television or broadcast, you know, they are not going to lose the war. And I think it's probably true they are not going to lose. Let's make sure that they don't win. But what does it mean not losing? Does it mean that, you know, Ukraine is losing? That mean that we are losing? Means that we have at our border this terrible problem? Hard to tell.
The cost to Ukraine has already been so high in humanitarian terms, in terms of the refugees, the people who've lost their houses and their lives. What can the EU do to help Ukraine ride this out? We've talked a little bit about the budget for reconstruction and just for helping the country sustain itself. Is this going to be enough? Are there vast more resources needed? I've seen a figure of $60 billion, which seems like something Europe could do on its own on top of what's already been promised. What do you think?
So I think that, you know, we are supporting Ukraine a lot. We means the European Union and the member states, right? We are supporting Ukraine a lot in financial terms, much more than the United States. On the other hand, it's the opposite when it comes to weapons. There, the US support is crucial, and ours, because of the shape of our military industry, is much, much less. So if you are talking about, you know, support for livelihood in Ukraine and preparation and sort of, you know, keeping alive the possibility that one day they will enter into the European Union, I think we are able to do that. Different is on the ground, the military side. There, I must admit, I'm much, much less optimistic on those grounds, simply because of the reality that we do not have that kind of industry. And even though we are taking commitments to rebuild armies, military industry, defense industry, that will take time. And, you know, 10 years is much, much too long for that. So there, the US is absolutely crucial. So if the US and us are together in helping Ukraine, then I don't know whether the word rosy is warranted, but at least, you know, I won't have such dark thoughts. If one side is missing, and that is the US on the military side, then yes, we can continue to provide assistance, economic assistance, and a bit of military assistance. But that, I think, will not be sufficient.
Ben, what's the energy outlook? Have we reached a new equilibrium, or is there still a lot of uncertainty?
We're shifting towards a new equilibrium. The prices for gas are still about twice, just under twice, perhaps, what they used to be before the invasion, which, as this feeds through to households, will become less noticeable, perhaps. But for industries particularly, it's the big problem today in Europe, and heavy industries, people producing steel and ammonia, cement, who are struggling with high prices. And also for the wave of investment that we discussed in the last section that Europe would like to attract, things like producing solar panels, producing batteries. Some of the early stages are very energy intensive. And again, you're just feeding in lots of electricity into a factory to produce something. So if your energy costs are even marginally above Chinese is above American costs, then you have a problem. So for Europe, there's definitely one element where we still have prices above where they were, and that's causing still difficulties for energy-intensive industries. And I mean, the other big confusing factor is it's not really possible to reach an equilibrium because gas and oil are two fuels we've talked about so far today. We've talked about this from security of supply and Russia position. They're also the two fuels which the EU is passing legislation after legislation to try and reduce the consumption of and to try and move away from. So the equilibrium is one of them decreasing over time. And that's something, again, that's quite confusing for the natural gas industry, for example, thinking about long-term contracts. And now that all these long-term contracts we had with Russia that were going to expire in 2030, 2035, in line with broader energy and climate thinking, all of a sudden, one of the big questions in the last year has been, should we now go and sign long-term contracts with America for liquefied natural gas? And also in America, there's been lots of conversations about how much new projects they should permit, which is the White House recently announced a pause on these. So I think we've reached a new post-Russia equilibrium, but it's impossible to stick an equilibrium given the need to phase these out. And it creates a lot of challenges moving forwards in kind of thinking what's future demand for these fuels looking like, and how much do we still need to think about replacing Russian supply from a supply side, from getting supply from elsewhere, or how much are we now, which I think we are shifting into a phase where replacing these missing Russian molecules is now more about deploying solar, deploying wind, deploying heat pumps, and following through on the European Green Deal, which is where we would like to be.
Andre, any final thoughts on where we find ourselves 2 years into this war and what you would like listeners to take away from this going forward?
Yes, I think my main point, and sadly so, I would say very, very sadly so for me personally, I think we are witnessing by necessity the fact that Europe has to think about defense, military, rebuilding its armies, its defense, its weapon industry, something that I think all of us wished we would not have seen ever. As I said, my family comes from that part of the world. My mother comes from a place, she was born Russian, then she was Romanian, but the place where she comes from has been much in the news because it's a port on the Danube, on the Ukrainian side, just across from Romania, called Izmail, that has been bombed in recent months and has come in the news. It's not a very large city, but it's a quite important port. So for me personally, you know, the European peace project is something that means a lot to me. And this change now, which I'm not embracing with glee at all, but with necessity, is painful. And I think to many of us, especially those like me who are a little bit older, with the memory, I'm born after the war, but you know, I have the memory through my parents from World War II, the world war inside Europe is very, very painful. But yes, this is a major, major change with all kinds of consequences. And this will continue now for, you know, it's not like COVID, where, you know, COVID lasted 2 years and, you know, COVID has now become like the flu, something that we see every year. And, you know, we don't worry anymore, right? We don't wear masks anymore. It's sort of, we have closed the parenthesis. I think that this situation with Ukraine, with Russia, is not a parenthesis. It's really a change and a sad change.
A really sobering thought, because with COVID, we do see long-term disabling effects. There are still long-term consequences, but we have gotten used to it. And as Ben said, with the green transition, we are moving away from fossil fuels. And yet this war is still an active conflict, and it just spreads over almost everything. Thank you very much to Affiliate Fellow Ben McWilliams, to Senior Fellow André Sapir. I'm Rebecca Christie. I'm a Senior Fellow here at Bruegel and the Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. And I really appreciate your time today and joining us for this podcast. Thanks, and see you next time.